Robin Miller, another week in IndyCar news, the most important topic of the week, and I'm sure all of our listeners will agree. How you doing? You're still alive, clearly.
I'm 100%, buddy. I'm good.
100% sick. I love it. Well, we've got a little bit more downtime here before we get back to action in Pocono. Spoken with a couple of IndyCar drivers, team owners, and engineers so far this week, and they've all reported they're attempting to do a whole lot of nothing this weekend, which is really their last weekend off before we go racing 3 weekends in a row from Pocono to Gateway to Watkins Glen. A little bit of news. Nothing too crazy so far, but was quite glad to read your story and learn a little bit more about IndyCar securing its place at the Long Beach Grand Prix for the foreseeable future. You spoke with our man Kevin Kalkoven and Jim McCallion. What do they have to say about IndyCar continuing to be the staple there and flipping the middle finger to other series that we're trying to horn in on our action?
Well, you know what's interesting is that Jim said this a few months ago, and Kevin Kalkoven said it tonight. He said they'd never talked to anybody from the media people about Formula One coming to Long Beach. And in the document, Pook had already told him that he couldn't have a race before 2020. You know, there's some people that are just thinking maybe he was just trying to get the rights to it and then having maybe no intention of Formula One, but just having the rights to it so he could, maybe hold IndyCar up, which, I mean, that's just speculation. That's my speculation. But it's interesting that no one, you know, we've never had any confirmation that anybody from Formula One was even interested in coming back to Long Beach. I mean, Bernie was in 2013, but Bernie's not Formula One anymore. So I think it sounded like a complete waste of $150,000 to do that survey because it was pretty much a slam dunk. And the last 3 or 4 years, Long Beach is, I think, the IMSA doubleheader and the concert and the Robbie Gordon trucks and the support series. It's become one of the great weekends in American motorsports, and it's obviously IndyCar's second biggest race. So 6-year deal with a 5-year option, and you know, I think the only thing they want, they'd like to see a little bit less time to put the track up and to take it down. It's 60 days to put it up, 17 days to take it down. So they're going to work with the city to try and make it easier. Now, they have the streets open almost every day, but it does cause a lot of congestion. And so I think that's their big project moving forward. But, you know, other than the fact that they had to agree it's always going to be in April and there's going to be at least 14 cars, pretty much that's it.
Big takeaway I had is seeing as how the city paid KPMG $150,000 to do a full look into the numbers and decide which series they should align with, thinking about the rumored $1 million IndyCar spent with the Boston Consulting Group. Why we haven't started Miller and Pruitt's general firm of knowledge and speculation to horn in on some of that money. I mean, right now, you'd be somewhere racing a sprint car, and I don't know what I'd be doing, but brother, I think we're just leaving money on the table because, you know, we could probably come up with just as bad an answer as some of the professionals could. Well, we had an update that we did with Tino Belli, IndyCar's director of aerodynamics, gave us an update on when we might see the first aero screen test on track, and also shared some information about the development process. The fact that they're going into manufacturing with their first, I don't want to say final, but kind of sort of close to final aero screen, something that they've been working on Dallara's full-size simulator with. They've been doing computational fluid dynamic simulations with. Interesting to hear about Tino's thoughts on both some of the challenges faced by Formula One teams that have done testing with aero screens, and also reading about just some of the minutiae of, you know, now instead of the oncoming air at 200 miles an hour hitting a driver's helmet and, you know, keeping it firmly planted against the back of the headrest, to with an aero screen in place, that air actually coming up over and eddying backwards, and also a void, essentially low pressure in front of the helmet, actually pulling forward through low pressure and pushing from behind with the air curling over the aero screen into the cockpit. It's little stuff like that that I know I found fascinating.
I'm just interested in, what do you think it's going to look like? Will it go up 8 inches and across the front of the car? Have you seen any kind of drawing or just any kind of guess?
I haven't. I know that, again, we're having to rely on descriptions from Tino, from Jay Fry. They've been pretty consistent in saying they have had aesthetics in mind while creating this. And we're also keeping in mind that since this isn't a full canopy, like we've seen on some NHRA cars or, you know, like we would see in a jet fighter, since this is a partial, again, I'm even reluctant to use the word canopy in this instance, but kind of a partial, something along those lines that comes up. They've said all along that they have tried to blend this into the car to have it not come across as some big, you know, sore thumb that's sticking out, that's a visual affront. Smart, right, Robin? Because what we've been saying for years about the Dallard EW12, that it just hurts the eyes. It's pretty smart if they've gone through the effort of designing this new 2018 bodywork that I think most of us, the consensus is, it's pretty. It definitely looks really nice. Well, why would you go through that and then stick something on that just makes you go, oh my God, and now it's ugly again? So, haven't seen it, but from the descriptions we've heard from those two, they've described it being somewhat low, blending in, not really standing out when you look at it from 20 feet or so. So, you know, you can probably let your mind wander a little bit, but I don't think it's going to be quite as obvious as we've seen tested by Red Bull and Ferrari, but at this point, it's still speculation.
All the Jacques Villeneuve, Mario, Parnelli, AJ, they're all like, no, that don't ruin open wheel racing. And I'm kind of like that. Nope. We both love Justin Wilson. Who didn't? Probably the most popular guy to come down the pike in 30 years. And you know, what a fluke that he loses his life. And could it, something like that have saved him? I don't know. But there was always something about open wheel racing that just, that's why people watch, because it's dangerous and it's like nothing else. And you can see the guy driving and can't see him like you used to, but you can still see him. I don't know. I'm with you. I hope it's a nice little blend that doesn't stand out. And maybe in a year or two, you'll just kind of, it'll, you know, blend in with the scenery and you won't notice it.
And we'll get into a couple of the other news topics of the week here shortly, but this is something that I did want to delve into, is kind of the meaty topic for throwing back and forth. When Justin died, I mean, granted, Dan died 2011. I don't know if there's an aero screen or anything else that you could have put on the old, the previous generation Dallara that would have kept Dan's helmet from being hit by the steel pole while he was, you know, flipped up and in the air and traveling along as he did. When Justin died, that for me was the senselessness of it, I think, is what bothered me the most. And so my initial reaction and somewhat ongoing reaction of, oh, hey, if this is not just a, you know, something crazy, but if something can fly through the air and hit you in the helmet and kill you, then maybe we do need to think about using something to try and block that or divert it. I mean, how's this? Imagine if a driver's feet were exposed while racing an IndyCar and could be hit by debris, and otherwise you pretty much guarantee the drivers would be saying, not a chance. We are going to put a cover over the pedals. We are going to do something so that my feet aren't going to, and toes aren't going to get smashed by a nose cone, a tire that comes off, whatever it is. I don't know why we would think of not protecting a driver's exposed helmet with the same kind of veracity. You could say, well, but they have a helmet on, right? So, whereas a driver's feet would be, you know, that's, other than a thin shoe, that's flesh just sitting there ready to be, you know, pulverized by something bad hitting it. With a helmet, you'd say, well, at least there's a protective barrier. So maybe that's a reason there's some hesitance towards that. But I will admit, and Maybe we're prone to this, and I don't think I'm saying anything surprising here in that Justin was one of my closest personal friends, beyond a driver and, anything on the professional side. Definitely hurt to lose someone that close. And I'll also admit that, now, I mean, frankly, we're coming up on the 2-year anniversary of his death. I'm walking back some of my stronger feelings about the need for cockpit protection in open wheel cars. I haven't, Robin, and I'd be lying if I said I have 100% firm, fixed opinion here. I'm not sure if I'm ready to say I don't believe we need anything. Hey, these are gladiators. They freely choose to do what they do, and open wheel involves having your head partially exposed, and if you get hit and killed by something, well, you accepted that fate. I don't know if I'm all the way there. If there's something we could use that doesn't destroy the look and feel and spirit of an open wheel car, that maintains, truly maintains the bloodline of what open wheel racing has been. I'm leaning more on that side, leaving the option open of if there is a small aero screen or something that doesn't destroy the looks of the car, and also honestly maintains a little bit of that element of danger, which separates open wheel from NASCAR and sports cars and everything else where you've got a roof over your head. I don't want to say I'm in the middle on this one. There was a point about 2 years ago where I was really far to one side. Gotta cover up the driver's helmets. Gotta. I'm walking that back. I can't say if I'm exactly in the middle, but I think I'm leaning a lot more towards traditional with some sort of option for maybe this small thing that it seems like Tino and Jay are saying they have in mind. So it's a complex thing though, man.
Yeah, well, but I think your story kind of pointed that out today. I mean, we'll wait and see. I mean, in no rush to judgment. We'll see if it's not this big thing that your eye goes right to and it just kind of blends in, and people think it's going to help. Okay, fine. What the hell? Everything else has changed. I get it. No problem. I just, it's just, I don't know. I'm too old, and I eat lunch with too many of those guys like Vookie and Koonsman and all the boys that, and they, it's just a different way to look at it, because, there was no safety in the 60s, let's face it. And now everybody's really conscious of it. So it's just a complete different mindset. And so, like I said, reading your story, it didn't sound like it was going to be this god awful big thing sticking out that you're going to go, oh my God. So hopefully it won't be.
Adding to this, and maybe closing on this, interviewed Sebastian Bourdais a couple weeks ago on this topic. I was going to end up writing I think a commentary about it, and for whatever reason that didn't happen. But Seb had some really interesting thoughts on this. It's not the first time he shared it, but it was really interesting to hear from him. Was definitely in light of his thoughts since he's had one of the two most violent crashes we've seen in IndyCar since Justin's accident at Pocono. And I mean, granted, even that wasn't that violent, just we know, how violent it was in terms of physical impact. But if you think of Sebastian's 227 mile an hour foot flat on the throttle crash into the turn two wall at Indy, and we could also obviously think of Scott Dixon's crazy crash during the race as well. But think of what Seb went through. Broke the right wing of his pelvis off of his skeleton, had to have that reattached, upside down, on fire, just again, nasty accident. You would think someone who's gone through a very traumatic incident like that and who was incredibly close with Justin, these two were, super close friends as well. You'd think Seb would have come out on the other side of this big Indy crash of his, much more sensitive to the topic of driver safety, maybe more pro aero screen or otherwise. And at least in our interview, a week or two ago, he was the exact opposite. He said, "Look, I race sports cars too. I love sports cars. I know exactly what it's like to climb into one with a roof over your head and doors and all these things, really truly protecting every single part of your body. But that isn't an IndyCar. What what are we going to do? Put a roof on these things and climb in from, you know, slide in through the door on the side? And I mean, there comes a point where you have to accept what it is these cars are, and then also accept that there are folks like me that choose to do this for a living. And that, I think, Robin, and I'm guessing, but I think I'm right, I think that's probably a lot of what you hear from, you know, your lunches and dinners with a lot of the old timers that you're friends with. You know, Bourdais is of the mindset that, look, I could go drive sports cars and the safety would be amazing. When's the last time we heard about, you know, constant fatalities in sports cars or, you know, fendered vehicles and cars with roofs? Doesn't happen that often, but there's a choice. There's a bit of accepting that this is dangerous. We are a rare breed. That's why we are IndyCar drivers. You could say the same thing about Formula One until their halos arrive next year, but these are different people, right, Robin? And that's where I think the exception, you know, that's where the exception comes in.
For the guys that, you know, I mean, Villeneuve is he's like his old man. You know, he's like, you know, if it bothers you, go drive a 10 top, go get a sport. If you don't want to do it, then don't get in it, because there's a million guys that'll take your place. And that's the same in USAC or the World of Outlaws or whatever. You know, if all these guys that said, you know, they drive sprint cars 100 times a year, they're like, hell yeah, I'll drive an Indy car. You don't have to put anything. I just want to drive it. It's the way that you were kind of raised in racing, I think. And, you know, you've been around a long time. I mean, you're talking about the driver's feet being exposed. I just think about the 80s when the joke was, how do you tell a kart driver? Because he's got the handicap parking sticker, because their feet and their legs were all smashed up. And they finally moved him behind the center. They moved him back behind the wheel where they belong, but it took a while for that to take part. But I just think in something like this, there is an element. The reason that Gurney and Parnelli and Mario and AJ and the Unsers are so revered, and Rutherford and Johncock, is that they were gladiators in an era that was lethal, and they survived and they thrived, and people had an appreciation for them that they were doing something most people couldn't do and didn't want to do. And that to me, in a nutshell, is open wheel racing. It's the most dangerous form of racing, and it's the badge of honor and the badge of courage. That's what you wear. So, like I said, I just hope that part of it doesn't get washed away with whatever screen this thing is.
Let's move over to our friends at Ed Carpenter Racing. Spoke with Ed during the Mid-Ohio race weekend, had a good long catch-up on a number of items. One of them specifically was about 2018. Ed's always been pretty cagey, Robin, about future plans. You know, he's not one of those guys who's always talking about, well, I'm considering this guy and that guy. I mean, he's, you know, tends to play things fairly close to his chest, but not a big fan of change. We know that. Wasn't exactly prepared to say I'm going to keep both drivers or want to keep both drivers. Interesting part of the conversation was twofold. One, we've heard him say this a couple times over the years, recently at least, about, you know, a desire to expand the team so you could have two full-time cars and have his oval entry be the third car, a part-timer, call it 2.5 cars. That was great to hear and hear him, you know, continue to discuss that desire. I think that would actually make his life a lot easier and a lot less complicated when we look to 2018, knowing that he mentioned Spencer Pigot, who you and I speak of highly on a fairly regular basis, said that his window to hold on to him might be a little bit shorter than was desirable, whereas his negotiating period with Jerry Hildebrand's a little bit longer. So part of me wonders if a Michael Andretti, Chip Ganassi, whomever else, might be looking at a kid like Pigot, who's shown a heck of a lot of potential as someone who, you know, might flesh out some of these kind of factory-assisted Chevy and Honda rosters where you're going to need a young gun who can step in and deliver. What are your thoughts there? Knowing that Ed seems to be keen on both of his drivers, but also, as he told us, he doesn't want to be a driver development farm who grooms the New Gardens and the Pickets of the world so they can go off and beat Carpenter in the future.
Yeah, I guess I'm glad that he gave Spencer another year and gave JR a chance. And, you know, I think that American theme's fabulous, and especially Ed's roots. But the thing with Pigot is he's a lot younger than JR. I think the team really kind of rallies. I think the team would like to keep Spencer more than they'd like to keep JR, just from what I've observed, just because of that youthful exuberance and aggression. And, you know, not that JR isn't still very fast on ovals, he is, but I think Spencer still has to learn ovals, but he's done kind of a Joseph Newgarden this year. I mean, he's had some crashes, but he's been fast, he's been passing cars, and that's what you look for in the future. Guys get so little chance anymore to show what they've got because, you know, Sage Karam 1 year and done, and, you know, so far Spencer's got to run the Indy 500, but he has no oval experience, and, you know, he's still a kid, but, you know, you got to get him out there, and that's why it'd be great if Ed had two full-time cars and he just ran the Indy 500, that'd be perfect. But if I was the car owners looking around this paddock, I would hope that they've been paying attention to what Spencer's, how he's raced and how many cars he's passed and the strides he's made this year. And everybody's so judgmental and so quick to judge, and so they just don't remember. It took Johnny Rutherford 10 years to win the Indy 500. And he would have probably been out of a ride, but guys kept losing their lives, so he kept getting a chance, and finally it clicked. And he won Indy three times. But people just don't realize how long it took guys to... Bobby Unser, he didn't do anything his first two or three years except crash. And, you know, it's interesting to me that people want to pull the plug on people so quick nowadays in racing. And it's just the opposite. Give these guys a chance to develop. And I just hope Ed keeps him. Because I think Spencer's the kind of guy... You know, I don't think the owners are just... You know, I'm not sure how many of these owners actually pay attention sometimes, but I think, you know, he'd be one of those guys that you could build your team around. He's a kid. I mean, I think that's what he would, you know, Ed could sign him for a 3 or 4 year deal and say, look, you're with me and I'm behind you and let's go racing, period.
I mean, realistically, what is different about Piggott than a young Ryan Hunter Ray? Than a young Graham Rahal, than, you know, a number of other young drivers that we've seen. Simon Pagenaud, who were really impressive in the junior open wheel formulas, who came in, were very solid their first year or two, weren't necessarily lighting the world on fire, but definitely showed potential. And with a couple of years under their belt, that's when you started to realize, ooh, you know, this is more than promise. There's something real here. And, you know, having seen all those guys come up and come along, there's everything that you're mentioning. There's that exact kind of potential which you hope team owners are looking at. And I'm with you. Look, if Roger Penske says, hey, Spence, you're driving for me next year. If you're Spencer, you say, yes, sir. If Chip calls, if Michael calls, you say yes, because those are bigger organizations. You just say yes. But I will admit there's a big part of me, Robin, that hopes and really wishes that Spencer can and will not only stay with Ed Carpenter Racing, but have a full-time opportunity next year, because I think he's at that stage where he needs continuity to come into himself, to become that next Hunter Ray, that next Ray Hall, etc. He's drove for Ray Hall last year, then moved over to Carpenter. He's been at Carpenter, but then went over to Juncos for the 500, is back at Carpenter, but isn't doing any ovals with Carpenter. And if he's jumping to another team next year, again, I realize a bigger opportunity would benefit him in the long term. But if he can stay, continue to learn with, you know, good team owner and Ed, good team manager in Tim Broyles, his engineer Matt Barnes, who's a rock star, just... build. If this kid can build, some of the little mistakes, the crashing and riding off, or I shouldn't say riding off, but at least having to build up a fresh car for the race like he did morning warm up at Mid-Ohio. These little things where you go, all right, we'll grant you those now, but not next year. If he's having to come into a new house next year, learn everybody, try and get settled again, I actually think it would be a bit of a setback for the kid. All right, well, let's round up the last item or two here, Robin. Spoke with our friend Zach Brown last week about some of the things going on in the house of McLaren and whether they might continue to be a Honda-powered Formula One team, and also whether his new friends at Andretti Autosport might continue with Honda or whether they would move to Chevy, and whether the engine movement on both sides or one or the other side might influence or complicate working together in the future. And as he told us, it's 50-50. We would obviously love to see our boy Fernando Alonso back, good old triple F, fast effing Fernando. Love to see him back for a second go at the Indy 500. You know, there's obviously been folks saying, well, he could be coming to IndyCar. Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of coulds, but what are your thoughts about how these two dynamics of one team, a little bit of a limbo with what it's going to do on its engine front, its partner team in America, a little bit of limbo in terms of its engine supply situation for next year, and whether that could leave Fernando in a case of one and done, or heck, even what Fernando might choose to do on his own.
After reading your interview with Zach, I mean, I think it sounds like a long shot he's going to come here. But I think the interesting thought is Michael just waiting to make his decision or announcement? Is he going to stay with Chevy, or is he going to stay with Honda or jump to Chevy? Is he waiting to see what Alonso's going to do? Would that, obviously, that could be a big influence if Honda brought Alonso and said, we're going to run the whole year with you. But reading your story, and our boy Chris Medlin, who covers Formula One for Racer.com, you know, he gave it a 20% chance. The guy makes $40 million a year, and I realize he doesn't need the money, but he'd go from $40 million to whatever, $2 or $3 million. And the other thing is, he hadn't won a Formula One race in, what, 4 or 5 years now? And he's a two-time world champion. I don't think he wants to just walk away and not having, and it's not his fault, but if McLaren would show some promise, and evidently the last test or two has been better, but it just seems like to me, He's been pretty open. Hey, I'm going to make a decision here in September, October, and I'm counting anything out. But I think it'd be surprising if he did come to IndyCar. But if he did, and he went back to Michael, and Michael stayed with Honda, and Alonso's a full time guy, that's big time for IndyCar. That's a win for a long time, because that guy draws people.
Well, here's one thing I know for damn sure. I don't care how much money he makes a year. He isn't waking up and going to Mug and Bun. Yeah, there are no pork tenderloin sandwiches available where he lives, so I don't care how much money that guy makes. He's missing out if he isn't an IndyCar. My two favorite stories of the week center around one Anthony Joseph Foyt. The first one, yes, boys and girls, IndyCar drivers, some of the most elite athletes in the world. Even they can run out of gas. Our boy Connor Daly tweeted out that photo of him parked on the side of the highway having run out of fuel, which there's just something brilliant about that, isn't it? It reinforces the point that despite an IndyCar driver, F1, NASCAR, you know, they might be, you know, kings and queens of their discipline, but you know, they're just like us. The same stupid crap that we do happens to these guys too. So I had a little bit of chuckle about that with Connor. But my favorite story of all, Robin, which you wrote, was our boy Anthony Joseph, for certain sure, won him some money with a single horsepower last weekend. Tell me about that. That's the best.
Just sitting here typing on Saturday afternoon, he calls and he goes, hey, my horse won. I said, well, Christ, don't call me now. And he says he paid $16 to win. I said, well, why don't you call me 2 hours ago so I could have bet it? Well, I didn't do it, but Anthony bet it, and Tim Delrose bet it, and you know, I guarantee AJ bet it. Anyway, paid $16. He won $468,000, I think, to win that race. It was the West Virginia sweepstakes. He's now won almost $700,000 with a horse he paid $35,000 for, so... He's having a pretty good week.
And how much of that money do you think is still going towards crash repair bills that have been accumulated in recent years? Or do you think he's just putting that into bulldozers and African bee killing devices?
He bought a trash dump in Houston and all the dump trucks that go with it. And I think he paid $1 million for it. And he said he can sell it in a couple years for 3 or 4. I mean, AJ's got a lot of money and he knows how to make money. And he's been in the horses before. But this horse is evidently pretty special. He beat the horse that finished second in the Kentucky Derby last week, so he's going to be in the Breeders' Cup. And, you know, I think that's between bulldozers and horses. You know, AJ, he's pretty far removed, Marshall. You know that from. I mean, he goes to the races and he makes suggestions and stuff. But he's, I just think it's a habit, and he does it for Larry. But you know, when you were the king like he was, it can't be that much fun. And but I know he likes the ABC people, and they're a great sponsor. So Connor had a good race at Mid-Ohio, and he had a good test at Gateway. So AJ actually said, well, maybe we're on the right track there. I said, maybe. I hope so.
All right. Well, let's close with any Robin Miller recollections of other investments IndyCar drivers or team owners have made throughout the years, and whether any of those have paid off or been comical wastes of money. I mean, what's the old thing about basketball and football players in the 70s and 80s and 90s? They're always told to buy car washes because, you know, you could always make money there, but it seems like almost every single one closed or the guys went broke. Any IndyCar driver stories that come to mind about mistakes they've made investment-wise?
Well, Mario's car washes, the Hannup car washes Mario had, I think did okay. Michael Andretti had a restaurant with Mike Piazza of baseball fame, and it flamed out. Probably Tom Sneva is probably our hero for, if you came up with an idea and only needed $10,000, Sneva didn't ask many questions, he just invested. Like, he bought an island once in the middle of the ocean. It turned out to be, I don't know, 11 by 11 feet, and so that, and he bought a pig farm once. That was a disaster. He bought some kind of a sapphire deal once. My favorite story is this: he bought a sand and gravel business with some guy, and we were playing golf one day. I said, "What the hell do you know about sand and gravel?" He goes, "Well, I don't know anything, but you know, this guy, you know, looks like a good guy." So I didn't hear from him for a couple. I didn't hear about it for a while. So one day I said, "Hey, how's the sand and gravel business?" He goes, "Oh, that was an $80,000 mistake." So our boy Sneva has done very well because he had a percentage point of about 5 casinos in Vegas, and that paid big money when they sold everything, and he got a nice dividend check. But he likes, you know, he took a lot of chances on the racetrack, and he takes a lot of chances off the racetrack, and he's about like me. He hits about 25% in the NFL, so there's one born every minute. He's just got more. He can outlast me because he's got more ammo.
Well, hell, we better wrap this up and give Sneva a call. I got a bunch of ideas I could have him fund. So, well, get better. Don't die on us. If any of y'all agree or massively disagree with anything we have covered tonight, let us know on Twitter, at Marshall Pruitt, or on Facebook. Robin's definitely very active there only, and you can hit me there as well. Always great to hear Pruitt, Miller, you're idiots or you're brilliant.
That's not very often. All right, son, we'll talk soon.